Let's begin with our motivation. So really appreciate the freedom we have just to practice the Dharma together. That we don't live in a country without religious freedom, where you have to hide your spiritual practice, fearing arrest or imprisonment if they find you out. So let's not take our freedom for granted, but really make good use of it while we have it. And so to continually expand our heart, to take in the welfare of other living beings, whether they are people we agree with or don't agree with, or look like us or don't look like us, or from the same social class or from a different social class or different ethnicities or religions or whatever. Let's look beyond all of that and simply see sentient beings who want happiness and not suffering, and to open our hearts to them in that respect. Also knowing that their minds are under the influence of afflictions and ignorance, especially the ignorance that can't differentiate between virtue and non-virtue. And so realizing that their minds are obscured in that way, just like our mind sometimes gets obscured in that way, then let's not judge them or throw them into categories and think that's all they ever have been or all they ever will be. And so just as we aspire for freeing ourselves of faults and generating our good qualities limitlessly, let's see that all others have that same potential, and to do our best to work towards fulfilling that in them as well. And of course, to do that most effectively, the more we've purified our mind and generated enlightened qualities, the more effective we will be in doing that. So instead of just wishing others to be happy and free of misery, let's actively try and bring that about, especially by generating bodhicitta and trying to understand emptiness. And in this light, knowing how the Arya Bodhisattva's practice is very inspiring and is a very good map for us to do that. And so that's what we'll listen to this evening. Okay, so somebody said that regarding when the Bodhisattva receives the prediction, that a Zen commentary started off on saying that the prediction is by a Buddha, but the time varies and can even be given to one who has not given rise to the mind of wisdom. So, not giving rise to the mind of wisdom can be very vague. It's very vague. Which kind of wisdom? Direct, non-conceptual, inferential, you know. But anyway, it kind of reaffirms our conclusion from last week, is that nobody states it definitively, that as far as we know so far. Okay, so the first one amongst us to get a prediction, make sure and tell the others. Okay, so I just want to cover a few things. Shall we go through the Bhumis and why what they're called, what they are? First ground, joyous, why? Yeah, and second one, stainless, why? Yeah, okay. Third one, luminous, why? Yeah, they have that light, but venerable, sometimes found in Betsy Knapper's thing, that it said that, what was it? That they go after the transmitted Dharma, very sincerely wanting to learn the transmitted Dharma, and are like a light of Dharma for others in the sense that they teach it to them. Yeah. Okay. Actually, my name Chudrun, Chu, that's kind of my name, Light of Dharma, anyway. Okay, doctrine is usually 10. Yeah. Then, fourth one, radiant, why? Yeah. Yeah, I think, and also because they have that appearance of light in their meditation as well. Okay, fifth one. And why? They aren't, they can't be pushed around by Mara, the big bully. Okay, then sixth one. Why? They are approaching, yeah, Buddhahood. Seventh one. Yeah, why? They can go in and out of those meditative concentrations very, very quickly. Yeah. Eighth one. Immovable. Why? Yeah, they're not moved by the signs of true existence. Yeah. Okay, ninth one. Excellent intelligence. Why? Yeah, so they really excel in that whole thing about teaching the Dharma to others, and they can answer questions almost as good as the Buddha can, but not quite. And the tenth one, cloud of Dharma. Why? We, but you should read ahead. You rain down, they give the teachings like, you know, a rainfall of the Dharma. Yeah, well, that's going to come. So I just want to go back to the eighth ground a little bit, okay? So the eighth ground, I'm movable. They're not moved by, you know, the signs of true existence or by the self-centeredness. So it seems like, they have what is called, they, let me see where this is. They're irreversible at the eighth stage, okay? They receive signs of irreversibility. So what this means, and this the signs of irreversibility can happen on the path for sharp people, sharp disciples. Path of preparation on for middling on path of seeing, and for modest, we won't say dull, we'll be polite, modest, at least by the eighth bhumi. Okay. And so what these signs of irreversibility mean is that these bodhisattvas will are irreversible from awakening. So they, which means here that they have no fear of self-centeredness arising. So it seems like that what they mean by the signs of irreversibility is, you know, when you kind of cut self-centeredness for good. So one reason at the eighth bhumi that they are indomitable is they have no more fear of self-centeredness arising. And here self-centeredness means attaining awakening for your own benefit alone, or attaining nirvana for your own benefit alone. Okay, so and they say there's 44 signs of irreversibility. Yeah, for example, having turned away from the manifest grasping at true existence, which of course we knew, you know, because they've canceled out, they've removed all, even innate and the seeds of. Grasping at true existence. Okay. So then the question comes, but you know, you're saying that they're irreversible from enlightenment here on the eighth bhumi, but they can't lose their bodhicitta once they get to the middle part of the path of accumulation, which was, you know, two great eons ago. So, you know, aren't they reversible from that point on? Why are we making this deal about them now? Well, yeah, they were irreversible then, because their bodhicitta can't degenerate, but they did not receive the signs of irreversibility at that time. Okay, so I guess you get certain signs, for example, not having manifest, self-grasping, you know, that can appear at different times, you know, later on in the path, and also in the sense of completely removing self-centeredness. You know, a bodhisattva on the path of accumulation, the middle part of it, you know, they won't lose their bodhicitta, but they still might have some centeredness in there, thinking about, well, yeah, you know, my own enlightenment would be kind of nice, but you know, they're able to oppose it. You know, my own nirvana, my own peace would be really nice, but they're able to oppose it. Whereas, you know, it's very different when that has been completely eliminated and you don't even get that thought in your mind anymore. Yeah. Yeah. It's like the cats when I can see they're about to do something naughty, you know. Like Maitri, I see she's circling one of the offerings. And I say, don't you even think of it, you know? So this is kind of like with those bodhisattvas. It's like they don't even think of their own attaining their own nirvana and leaving others behind once they've received the signs of irreversibility. Okay. So, the lower Aryas, you know, I kind of said this last time that the lower Aryas, they still have afflictions. Their afflictions may manifest once in a while, but they are not strong enough to create any polluted karma. So once you're an Arya, you no longer create polluted karma. Here, polluted means under the influence of ignorance. Okay? So their afflictions don't really function as afflictions because afflictions are usually things that disturb your mind. But once you become an Arya, they don't disturb your mind. Maybe they arise, but they can't really do anything much. An Arya is somebody who has realized emptiness directly and non-conceptually. So that's a big jump, you know, they've seen the nature of reality. And so they begin to eliminate the afflictions at that point. So, on the path of seeing, which is when they first see reality directly, yeah, then they eliminate the acquired afflictions, which you get from studying wrong philosophies and wrong psychologies. And then on path of meditation, the next path, they start removing the innate afflictions, the ones that have been with us since beginningless time. Okay, so these bodhisattvas that, you know, the lower Aryas, in other words, from Bhumis 1 to 7, okay, they need what's called coarse effort. But of course, coarse effort for them is like super subtle effort for us. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, we would look at their effort as super subtle, you know. But they need this kind of effort to prevent grasping at true existence arise. Okay, but their effort is subtle compared to our effort to keep the grasping of true existence from arising. Okay, we can't even, yeah. Anyway, it's almost always there for us. Okay, so, yeah, so they aren't indomitable at that part because they really have to put forth some effort. Immovable, that's the one I meant, immovable. Why they're immovable at the eighth ground is because they're no longer, you know, subject to that. Thanks for correcting me. Yeah. Okay. Then, yeah, then the same thing with the mental body that, you know, you can get it at the path of seeing, the first bhumi, if you're a sharp level, or at least by the eighth bhumi, if you're more modest level practitioner. Okay, and that is produced, the mental body is produced by the latencies of ignorance and unpolluted karma. And here what unpolluted karma means is karma means the mental factor of intention in the mind of that Arya to give rise to a mental body. So that's what unpolluted karma means. Yeah, so their intention to give rise to a mental body isn't influenced by ignorance. It's influenced completely by compassion. Yeah, and a very fervent, a genuine fervent aspiration to be able to benefit others. Okay, so then just to review also on the seventh ground, the perfection that it becomes unsurpassed means it's gotten really good. You know, of course, you still continue to improve it, so you do surpass it. But is skillful means, yeah. On the eighth ground, it's unshakable resolve. On the ninth ground, it is power, right. But remember last week, I double-checked, and this thing about the eight controls that about it, that does happen on the path of the eighth bhumi, okay, where they have eight controls, where they can control their lifespan, their requisites, their rebirth, their emanations, and so forth. Ten controls on the eighth bhumi. Yeah, okay. 10 controls on the eighth bhumi. Yeah. And then also the pure ground bodhisattvas, which are 8, 9, and 10, they do a practice called the equality of samsara and nirvana. Okay? So so here what it means for them is that they that no grasping at true existence manifests in their mind, even in the break times. But they're pure ground bodhisattvas, so they've eliminated it. So, of course, it's not going to manifest. But this is, you know, really emphasizing it. So why would you call it the equality of samsara and nirvana if you don't have grasping, a manifest grasping at true existence? It's because you see both samsara and nirvana as equal in terms of being empty of inherent existence. Okay, so this, you hear this phrase a lot, the equality of samsara and nirvana. And then people who don't know what they're talking about You know, because these terms sound, they sound really good, don't they? The equality of samsara. Samsara and nirvana are completely equal. Yeah? You can be in samsara and simultaneously be in nirvana. So if that's the case, if nirvana's here already and we're already in nirvana, then we don't need to keep precepts. That's only for dodos, you know? We don't need to, like, try and tame our mind because this is samsara and nirvana are equal. Okay? So this makes absolutely no sense. Yeah. So when we say samsara and nirvana are equal, it means they're both the same in being empty of inherent existence. Okay? Which means don't concretize your samsara and don't concretize your nirvana. Okay? They're both equal in that way. However, on the level of conventionalities, they're quite different. When you're in samsara on the conventional level, you are under the influence of afflictions and karma. When you are in nirvana on the conventional level, you are free from afflictions and nirvana. So your experience is completely different. Okay? So it's similar. You know, we can say, you know, the thermos and the sheet of paper, the equality of the thermos and the equality of the medicine and the rat poison. Or they're just regular poison. The equality of medicine and poison. Okay? Well, yeah, they're both empty of inherent existence. They're equal in that way. Does that mean that you can take poison when, you know, in the same time you need medicine? Yeah? Does that mean that, you know, one becomes the other and they serve the purposes of the other? No. Okay.
When you compared the rat poison to the medicine, I mean, you couldn't really compare rat poison to samsara, could you?
But the point here is, just because two things are both empty of inherent existence, okay, doesn't mean that those two conventional objects are exactly alike in their function. Okay?
Okay.
That's the point of the analogy.
Okay.
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 So I'm comparing, you know, poison to samsara and medicine to nirvana just because I wanted to just compare two things. I could have said the sheet of paper and the thermos. They're both equal in being empty of inherent existence, but that doesn't mean that the sheet of paper can function as a thermos and the thermos can function as the sheet of paper. Okay? Yeah, that's the point we're getting at. Okay? Simply because, you know, you sometimes read this expression in books and then people kind of invent their own meaning for it and kind of go off to la-la land somewhere with it. Yeah. Yeah. We all do, you know? Sometimes you read something, you know, I know when I started the Dharma, I read something and they talked about subtle mind and I thought, oh, when I'm meditating and my mind gets even a little bit calm, that must be subtle mind. Like, wrong, you know. I was like way off base. But you know, when you don't know much, you hear something and it's like, oh yeah, I must have experienced that. Yeah. 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 And it's the, you know, I'll be enlightened by Tuesday thing. Yeah. Yeah. One of my old Dharma friends wrote me and she said, yeah, when I first started Dharma, I was like, sure, I would get enlightened this life. And then the more I started studying, the more I realized it probably wasn't going to be this life because there's an awful lot you have to do, you know? So, okay. So that's the signs of irreversibility. Okay. Also, along that line, there's three times somebody asked the question about establishing fortitude for emptiness. Somebody asked me that. I don't know if it was in a class or outside, but fortitude for emptiness. So again, that has three times: the sharp faculties on path of preparation, the middle on path of seeing, and the modest ones on path of the eighth bhumi. Okay, so, and you can see why, because at those three times, those are very significant changes in terms of your realization of emptiness. Because a path of preparation, you know, that's when you have the union of serenity and insight on emptiness. So that's a huge jump from where you were before. Yeah, where you had serenity over here and insight over there, but you couldn't get them to cooperate. You know, one kind of infringed on the other one. But path of preparation is when they, you know, they're completely, well, they're joined, yeah, and they help each other instead of obstruct each other. So that's a big change in your realization of emptiness. Path of seeing, again, a big change, because that's the first time you see emptiness directly, non-conceptually. Yeah, path of eighth ground, eighth bhumi, that's another big change, because at that time you no longer have any grasping at true existence or its seeds in your mind stream at all. So the way you see emptiness is going to be, you know, I mean, in meditative equipoise, you're still seeing emptiness in the same way, but because your mind is free from all the afflictive obscurations, it's going to make a huge difference, I would think, in how you saw emptiness, and especially in the break time, you know, that you may still have the appearance of true existence, but there's no way that you're ever going to buy into it once you're an eighth grounder.
This fortitude for emptiness, is that a particular kind of realization of that? Is that what we're talking about? And how does that relate the perfection of that?
No, they're just calling it, there's this expression called the fortitude of realizing emptiness. Uh-huh. When we study fortitude, the perfection of fortitude,
right,
there's three kinds.
Right.
One is fortitude in terms of emptiness.
Right. But on the third bhumi, they have perfected it. So how does that relate to this thing about the...
When they say perfected, it doesn't mean it never advances and becomes more. I explained that at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, when they say that they reach an unsurpassable,
yes,
you know, thing, or they perfect that, it doesn't mean that it never gets better.
Right.
It just means that it reaches a certain level. Okay. But that doesn't mean that you couldn't have had dramatic changes in your fortitude realizing emptiness before or after that. Okay. I mean, my theory is that it's so easy. You have 10 grounds, so you associate each one with one of the perfections. Yeah. But actually, those bodhisattvas, they're practicing all the perfections on all of the grounds. Yeah. So, yeah, you can say on this ground it reaches, you know, some good state. But, you know, if the perfections were in a different order, you could probably have said that about the next ground too, or the previous ground. You know, that's just my idea.
It seems like the timing of these things supports that idea. There's a big variety in the timing of all these accomplishments.
Right. Like on the third, on the fourth, fifth, and sixth, realizing the 37 aids, that's fourth, and then the four truths is fifth, and then the sixth is the 12 links. On each one of those, it says you get a special wisdom. Yeah? But none of those, you know, only on the sixth one is it the perfection of wisdom. And actually, by the 10th, and that's the, and their wisdom is prajna, the 10th one is yeshe, which is also exalted wisdom. So then why does it say on three that you get a special wisdom? You know, why doesn't it just say it on the sixth? Yeah, because you're trying to like say how they're developing things, you know, and it's not just that oh, on the, you know, they get the 37 aids on the fourth ground. I mean, they've been practicing the 37 aids since before they, you know, even entered the path. And then they, you know, when they enter the path, you know, then actually when you talk about the 37 aids, when you do the correspondence between the Noble Eightfold Path, you know, and anyway, my point is, I don't want to go into that right now, is there's all sorts of different ways that you make different things correspond to different things. That doesn't mean that you should get super rigid about each one. Okay? Yeah? Yeah, I mean, there's a source. I'm sure it's the Sutra of the Ten Grounds that says this. Yeah? That says this. But my point is, you know, we get so rigid about things that, you know, the first bhumi is called the joyous. Oh, that must mean on the second bhumi you're not happy anymore. Yeah? And that on the first bhumi, you know, your ethical conduct is still not very good. Or you got perfect ethical conduct on the second bhumi, so now on the third, fourth, fifth, up to the tenth, you don't need to practice it anymore. Wrong. Okay? You getting what I'm saying?
That was my point.
Okay, what was your point?
My point was that it would seem that even if you had extremely modest faculties, if you were still having some issue with having some fear or not having your fortitude about practicing emptiness until the eighth ground.
But see, there you're defining what's the fear,
uh-huh,
as if that's
as if
the
it was at
fear
the beginning
that you have way before that.
Okay, then I have no concept of what that is.
Yeah, the fear that you have is, even now, sometimes people, you teach them about emptiness, and they go, that means nothing exists. You know, there are people who haven't even entered the path. That's part of fear of emptiness. Yeah, once you've realized emptiness, you don't have any fear of it. Yes, but still, your fortitude regarding emptiness increases. Okay? So fortitude doesn't need to... Fear isn't the only thing that fortitude counteracts. Okay?
I've heard that the good qualities of the Buddha can be increased limitlessly.
Yeah.
So then, you know, there's no end to these things getting better.
Limitlessly means that we cannot find a limit. Okay? Like innumerable means you can't count that many. But innumerable is different than infinite. So limitless means you can't see the end of it. Us ordinary beings can't see the end of it. It doesn't mean that you never become a Buddha because you can keep increasing your qualities so you never get to the end of increasing them so you never become a Buddha. Yeah, it doesn't mean that. Yeah, it just gets better and better. But once you're a Buddha, there's nothing more to do. It's called the path of no more learning, the path of no more training. Yeah, that's when His Holiness says you can have a good rest. Okay? But what I'm getting at is, do you see how sometimes the words lead us to misunderstand what's actually going on? Okay?
What do you need fortitude for realizing emptiness for? Maybe if you could give some examples, it would be like, because you'd have to, maybe you would have to be able to bear the memory of or all the things that you would
learn? I think here fortitude probably has a totally different meaning. You know, and here fortitude wouldn't mean, you know, bearing suffering mm-hmm. or something. Yeah, at the eighth bhumi, I mean, you don't have any suffering. Mm. But it's like, you know, your ability to I don't want to use bear emptiness or endure emptiness, but you know, on the eighth ground, you realize emptiness directly in your meditative sessions. And in your break time, there's no manifest true existence that happens at all. So you've overcome something. It's not some kind of gross suffering, is it? It's not some kind of fear. But something has been overcome. So I think that's what fortitude means in that kind of situation. Okay. Same thing like when I was explaining irreversible. Yeah. You know, the three signs of irreversibility, they don't start until later, but on the second, middle part of path of accumulation, you said this. Now you're saying they aren't reversible until there. You're contradicting yourself. No, you just define irreversible different at different times. It just has a different meaning at different times. Yeah. There was one, hold on, there's one of my, who was it? One of the Rinpoches in Madison, Sharpa Rinpoche, I think it was, when he was talking to Alex Burson one day. Because, you know, when you first start studying, all these things come up, you know. So, well, that doesn't match that. You start studying things, you know. Well, there's three divisions to this, and the first division has two, but those two you can also find in the second division. And the second division has three in it, and one you find here, and two more you find over there. And, you know, and so he just said to Alex, symmetry is stupid. Okay? In other words, you know, don't expect that the outlines and the terminology are going to fit our Western way of using words and using terminology and making categories. I mean, they make all sorts of categories, and this one overlaps with that, and two of them go in here, and four go over here, but it all comes down to the same thing there. But, you know, don't have that expectation. Yeah? Because what they're really trying to do is like draw your mind to see all sorts of interconnections that you probably wouldn't have otherwise seen. Yeah? So like this thing with irreversibility and when you actually overcome self-centeredness. Well, that makes you think, doesn't it? You know, okay, middle part of path of accumulation. Yeah? Then what's your self-centeredness going to be like there? Yeah. Versus later on after you've realized emptiness directly. Isn't that realization of emptiness going to affect your self-centeredness to some extent? You bet. Yeah. So it makes you think, okay, how do these things affect each other? Yeah, what's really going on as we're developing? Yeah. So it's not, you know, they give us this roadmap, but, you know, it's like, I'm sure it's different. It must be different for different people. Well, obviously it is. We found here all these different times where, you know, you have modest and middle and sharp realizing different things at different times. Yeah, so it isn't one size fits all.
How is it possible to cut self-centeredness for good?
For good?
Because, I mean, every day we wake up, no matter who we are, with a new head full of stuff.
Yeah.
No matter how holy we are. Isn't it happen to everybody?
Yeah, until the eighth ground. Yeah. And until a Buddha, I mean, a Buddha isn't going to be self-centered.
Okay.
Yeah. So how do you get rid of it? What did I just get done teaching? Two methods to get rid of it. 7-point cause and effect instructions, equalizing and exchanging self with others. Okay, so there's not some other method to get rid of self-centeredness aside from what the teachings you get, you know? It's like sometimes we think, well, these teachings, yeah, that's what you learn in teachings. But then there's some special kind of secret that they have hidden under the table somewhere, yeah, that if I practice that, you know, it's going to be really easy. Yeah, there's some other shorter method to get rid of self-centeredness. They just went through this, you know, because you need to teach something and it takes up a lot of time. So, you know, 7 points, we'll do that, equalize, exchange, and self and others. But the real key, you know, here on this slip of paper, just do this one sentence. Yeah? Yeah? It's not like that. Yeah.
Can I ask about a doubt?
Uh-huh.
This thing about removing self-centeredness on the eighth ground. Uh-huh. I wonder, for myself, I wonder if that's the self-centeredness that goes together with self-grasping. For sure, that's completely eliminated.
Yeah.
But I've asked a couple of times, you know, when is it that self-centeredness is completely eliminated? And I've never heard it pinned down to the eighth ground.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems to be at this, you know, at the eighth ground. I mean, it's certainly before Buddhahood. Yeah? So if it's not the eighth, then it's going to be the ninth or the tenth. Yeah? But it makes sense that it's the eighth, doesn't it?
No. No, it doesn't.
You don't think so?
You know, they talk about the two types of self-centeredness. There's the one that goes together with self-grasping. That I can see is completely gone at that stage. But I could imagine there could still be very subtle self-centeredness that's not eliminated till Buddha.
No, but here the self-centeredness is the wish to attain nirvana for yourself alone. That's the meaning of self-centeredness.
So that's the extreme, grasping at the extreme of peace.
That's what?
Grasping at the extreme of peace?
Yes, okay. Grasping at the extreme of peace. Clearly, by the eighth bhumi, you have the same, in terms of the abandonments, as a fundamental vehicle arhat. So if you were going to just attain your own personal peace, you wouldn't be on the eighth bhumi. You would just be a fundamental vehicle arhat.
Yeah. I remember something about the eighth ground bodhisattvas needing to be somehow subtly exhorted by the Buddhas at that stage.
Subtly what?
Exhorted by the Buddhists when we studied the middle
way?
Yeah,
probably. Because they're probably going, wow, I eliminated it. All the afflictive. You know, there might be the temptation, you know. Hmm. Oh, you know, I've eliminated the afflictive obscurations. But then, you know, it's got to be cut at that time. Because if it's not cut, then they're going to be a fundamental vehicle arhat. Which they're not, you know. Yeah, right. Exactly. Not after two countless great eons, you're not gonna, you know, give up the bodhisattva path at that point. Yeah.
So at that point, then they have essentially actualized their own personal liberation without losing their bodhicitta motivation.
Without what?
Losing their bodhicitta motivation.
Except they don't call it your own personal peace at that point.
Right, yeah. But they have the liberation from the afflictions.
It's the same on the eighth grounder. That's why, what did we do last time? We were talking about, what was it? It wasn't the, no, what was it? It was the one about a surpassing. Yeah, right. Yeah, one came, and then one came in terms of wisdom. So at the eighth ground, they surpass the fundamental vehicle, arhats, in terms of wisdom. Yeah, they eliminate the same afflictive obscurations those arhats have. Yeah, but their wisdom is conjoined with bodhicitta at that point. Yeah, so it's a very surpassing kind of wisdom, and they're definitely irreversible from enlightenment at that point. Okay, so anyway, it makes sense to me that when you've eliminated all the self-grasping, then, yeah.
Does the Buddha still collect merit?
No.
How does that work?
The Buddha has fulfilled the collection of merit, and the Buddha is just everything is spontaneously virtuous. Yeah?
So does that not, like the enlightened activities, does it not generate merit that sustain the Buddha being a Buddha?
What sustains, you don't need a new accumulation of merit to sustain your Buddhahood, because you've eliminated every single impediment to the mind. So then the mind naturally perceives all phenomena. Yeah? And naturally is involved in virtue. So you don't need to exert any effort, even subtle effort, to accumulate merit. The question comes, does the Buddha create karma? Well, merit is like essentially good karma, okay? The Buddha doesn't create good karma. What happens, there's this term trinlay, okay? Lay is the same word that's often translated as karma. It means activity. So in terms of the Buddha, you know, karma, instead of being the intention, is just enlightened activity. There's an enlightened intention all the time there that just keeps going. There's no effort needed to generate it at all, because there's nothing blocking it.
But then we talk about the definition of Buddha being the ultimate qualities of the two collections.
Uh-huh.
So ultimate means that's it.
Yeah. You fulfilled the two collections. You know? It's like you got your degree. You know? You did your classes. You have the requisite number of credits. You got your degree. Yeah. You don't need to keep going to college in order to keep getting your degree. You've gotten it. I mean, this is a very rough example, okay? Yeah. Okay, so, I mean, if you think about it, yeah, if you have the view that the mind is inherently tainted and it's impossible to eliminate all the taints, then you would have the view that, yes, you have to keep creating merit, and that you never get to the end of it because it's limitless, because your defilements are limitless and they're infinite, so you never get to the end of it. Okay? But that's not the view here. The view is that these things do have an end. It just is beyond our comprehension to think of what it takes to create the causes for that, or to think of what that would be like. Yeah, but when you attain Buddhahood, you're done. You have it. And there is nothing in your mind that can make you lose your realizations. There's no self-centeredness, no self-grasping, no afflictions, no seeds of any of those, no polluted karma, no anything that is impure that could possibly make you lose your Buddhahood. Okay? So this is very different than Christianity, where you start out pure and then some kind of apple incident happened. You know? And it was downhill after that. Yeah. So, yeah, but, you know, Buddhism looks at things completely differently. Yeah. Yeah, and if you grow up, I mean, Christianity, there is this gap between sentient beings and God, irreparable gap, can never be overcome. In Buddhism, there is not that notion at all. Yeah, so we have to, you know, do some reconditioning of how we think of human beings and human potential. Yeah, because it could be very different than what we learned in school or learned in the religion we grew up with or what our parents taught us or who knows what. Okay. Okay, now maybe, can I continue? I was just trying to review. Yeah. And just touch up some things that I think I didn't explain so clearly last week. I just wanted to touch them up. Okay. Okay, so I think the ninth ground, yeah. So 457, we'll review this. The ninth, like a regency, is called excellent intelligence, since by attaining true awareness, these bodhisattvas have excellent understanding on this ground. Through the maturation of this ground, they become the lord of a million worlds. They are unsurpassed by arhats and such regarding qualms in the minds of others. Okay, so they're really these ninth ground bodhisattvas. Remember, we were talking last time about, you know, like being the child of the monarch means that, you know, you're going to eventually get to the throne. So this bodhisattva is real close, okay? And so they really excel in these four specific perfect understandings of the Dharma, its actual words, its meaning, and they have confidence or eloquence in explaining it. Okay, so often you hear, you know, they talk about, there's some commentaries that explain the words of a sutra. There's other commentaries that explain the meanings of the sutra. So it's probably, you know, referring to those two ways of looking at the teachings of the Buddha. Okay, and so when you develop those, then of course you're going to have some eloquence in presenting the Dharma. And you're real close to Buddhahood, so you don't worry so much about making so many mistakes. Yeah, so there's some kind of confidence there. Okay, so that's why they're called excellent intelligence, because they have an exceptional practice of these four. Does that mean that on the eighth ground or the seventh ground that they didn't teach the Dharma very well? No. Yeah. Does that mean on the 10th ground it hasn't improved from the 9th ground? No. Okay. So it's just kind of, they're giving you some signpost here. Okay. So these bodhisattvas can reply to people's questions without contradicting themselves, without getting everybody confused. And probably they don't say 8 when they mean 10 and 3 when they mean 5 and, you know, these kinds of things. So what did I do last week? I said hurt instead of harm. Yeah, so they probably don't do those kind of things. Okay. So they're unsurpassed by arhats in terms of accomplishing the aims of sentient beings by resolving their qualms and teaching them and clarifying the meaning of the teachings to them in accordance with their dispositions, their thoughts, and their interests. So just think, I mean, how that it must be totally amazing to be that kind of bodhisattva and have that kind of confidence that you really know people's interests, you know their dispositions, you know kind of their karma, so you can see which kind of what you need to teach them now that they have the capability of understanding. You understand what kind of path do you teach them here, or solitary realizer, or bodhisattva path. You know, where do you start them on the path? You know, where, how do you explain the path? Because there's so many different frameworks to explain the path from. So these bodhisattvas, you know, can benefit sentient beings so amazingly with very little effort, because they can see so much. You know, their mind is so, has cleared away so many obstacles. Yeah. And they never get tired. So, they've eliminated any kind of self-centeredness, gross or subtle. So they, you know, don't get to the point where it's like, oh, I'm just too tired, you know. Forget it. Tell them to come back next week. You know, there isn't any of that. Okay. Okay, so now the 10th ground. Yeah. Power is the ninth ground. Yeah, eighth ground was resolve, unshakable resolve. Yeah, I always get these mixed up. So power, I don't know. They just say it's, I mean, well, their power to teach the Dharma is remarkable. Yeah?
Patru Rinpoche, in his description of Bhumi's call, that it's paramita of aspiration perfected.
Of aspiration?
Aspiration.
Aspiration.
On ninth Bhumi.
Really? Because that would be eighth.
The paramita of aspiration is perfected on ninth.
I don't know. Maybe there's different people who say different things.
I thought maybe it's meaning the same, so probably not.
The perfection of aspiration.
What does it mean, power?
Power.
In this case.
Yeah. I think it I'm just guessing here. I mean, again, it's like exceptional power. So what kind of power do you want to develop on the path? Yeah? You want, huh? Yeah, the power to benefit sentient beings. What is the best way to benefit sentient beings? Teaching the Dharma. Yeah? So I think when it talks about power here, my guess is that it's related to those four, what do they call them? Four perfect understandings. Okay, that you gain a special power in that to be of benefit to sentient beings. You know, maybe they get some special power too in making emanations. I don't know. It doesn't really say here.
I read this last week. I noticed that anything in the verse that we heard about power related to teaching.
Yeah.
And, you know, my issues with power, right?
Oh, so yeah. Oh, that's what I forgot, your issues with power. Yeah, but
and
here.
So then when I think about this, I also was remembering that all the Buddha's powers relate to knowledge.
Yeah, when we talk about the 10 powers of the Buddha.
They're all knowledges that the Buddha has.
Yeah, so they're abilities and knowledges. Yeah, so don't think of power as, you know, dominating. Power just means ability or capacity or, yeah. You have the power to do something, you have the ability to do it, the capacity, yeah. Okay, let me try again here. 10th ground. I was going to finish this all last week. I don't know if I'll even manage this week. Okay, so the 10th is the cloud of Dharma, because bodhisattvas rain down the holy Dharma, and these bodhisattvas are anointed with rays of light by the Buddha. Through the maturation of that ground, they become the celestial ruler of the pure abode, master of inconceivable objects of wisdom, supreme among great lords. Okay. By the way, the ninth ground, you're able to take rebirth as a Brahma lord over a million worlds. Okay. Okay, so here. So during the meditative equipoise, the 10th grounders go into innumerable millions of concentrations. Yeah. And remember, since they perfected it before, of going in and out of these concentrations really quickly, yeah, their mind is like so subtle and so flexible. It must be amazing. And then at the conclusion of what's called the Vajra-like concentration, okay, which is the last uninterrupted path, the uninterrupted path of the 10th ground, yeah, so the liberated path that follows this uninterrupted path is Buddhahood, okay? So it's, they say when it, they enter this Vajra-like concentration at the end of the 10th ground, that the Buddhas radiate light from the hair curls on their foreheads and bestow the empowerment of great rays of light on these bodhisattvas, blessing them so they obtain omniscient mind. At that time, all their cognitive obscurations are completely extinguished and they become fully awakened Buddhas. Now, my question is, do the Buddhas really, you know, from their hair curl, emanate light and zap somebody? You know, do they really do that? Isn't enlightenment attained through your own effort? You know, what does it mean for the Buddha to bless your mind stream when you're a 10th Bhumi Bodhisattva? Yeah? Maybe just give them an extra little boost of energy or something. But it's got that, you know, it's got to be done through the Bodhisattva's own meditation. The Buddha doesn't remove that last bit of cognitive obscuration. The Bodhisattva does. But do you really need light coming from the curl of a Buddha's forehead to do that? Or is, in other words, do we take this literally? Or is it somehow a poetic expression? Yeah, symbolic somehow of, you know, they feel so close to the Buddha that it's almost as if, you know, the Buddha's mind is just nudging their mind to do this last little bit. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. The
earthquakes.
Yeah.
Dharmic causality.
Yeah, dharmic causality. So again, do you, you know, does the earth really quake when somebody attains awakening?
Probably does for the person who's...
Yeah. I mean, my goodness, do we really, you know, are we going to need to build, hopefully somebody here someday will attain awakening. Do we need, you know, extra rebar in our buildings? Yeah. Yeah, but this, you know, the earthquake when you attain awakenings, that's got to be much more powerful than any kind of rebar. Yeah, yeah, of course, of course. This is probably going. What? What? Share the load. Yeah, woo, there's another Buddha. I don't need to work so hard now. Here, you go out to those sentient beings at Srivasti Abbey. You know, they're a tough bunch. Okay. Okay, so here, your ripening result is birth in the pure abode of Akanista. So here we need to talk a little bit about Akanista. So Akanista, the literal translation is not below. So it kind of means the highest. But there's different kinds of the highest. Okay? Yeah? So again, don't think, yeah. So there's different places named Akanista. In the form realm, okay, the form realm has 17 kind of grades. In some renditions, there's 18 grades. The top one is called Akanista. So that top grade, this is in the material realm, yeah? So it's not the immaterial concentrations, it's the material concentrations. And this is where the once returners and non-returners are born. So the fundamental vehicle sangha. So once returners are only gonna go to the desire, be reborn in the desire realm one more time. Non-returners are never gonna be reborn in the desire realm. So this is the place where those non-returners attain arhatship, that akhanista, the one that is the 17th or 18th, depending on how you count them, level of the material realm. This akhanista, yeah, is a pure land that the bodhisattva creates. Yeah, because I think the bodhisattvas, as I understand it, they have to create their own pure lands. It seems like that, you know. So it doesn't say that here, but I remember reading that somewhere. So theirs is called the place where a bodhisattva attains full awakening is also called akhanista. But it's not the same akhanista as in the form realm. Okay. Then there's Vajrayogini's pure land, which is also called akhanista. And that's a different akhanista. Okay? Yeah. So don't get, you know, if you see a sign that says akhanista straight ahead, you got to ask which one it is. Yeah. Yeah. Like that. Okay. So your ripening result, rebirth here, is in this pure land. And so that's where you attain full awakening as a bodhisattva in that Vajra-like concentration, which is the uninterrupted path at the end of the 10th bhumi.
So the beginning part talks about being reborn as what, Maheshwara, kings of the gods in the highest land. What does this king do? I mean, who does the king rule over?
You mean in these form realms?
In the 10th ground.
In the 10th ground? Oh, that they
to be
they
reborn. Rule.
Wait a minute. They
the beginning part of the chapter that talks about being reborn as Maheshwara.
Maheshwara. In which ground?
10th ground.
10th ground.
King of the gods in the highest land.
Yeah.
Is it the same thing?
But no, I don't think it would be the same thing because, you know, your own pure land is where you attain awakening. Maheshwara is a worldly god of some sort. So you're basically asking who is Maheshwara? Okay. 9th ground, Bodhisattva, great Brahma, Lord. Okay, Brahma is also in the form realm, but the lower material realm, lower levels of the material realm. Okay. On the 10th ground, Maheshwara, the king of gods in the highest land. Maybe that's the akhanista of the non-returners. I don't know. Your assignment is to look up who Maheshwara is. Okay? And come and tell us next week. So Bodhisattva's final continuum are bestowed the empowerment of great light rays. And then when they become a Buddha, they have the signs and marks of an actual Buddha. So they've attained the signs and marks before that, but they're a similitude of the Buddha's signs and marks. Now they have the actual one. Okay. So here comes Rinpoche saying, according to the sutra system, it's not possible to attain awakening in the desire realm, although it is possible in the tantric system. Okay. So at that last uninterrupted path, you eradicate all remaining stains. Okay, so then you're, you know, we always talk about abandonment and realization. So at each level of the path, you're attaining a certain abandonment and a certain level of realization. So here, all your abandonment becomes the true cessation of a Buddha, because you've abandoned everything. Okay. So the true cessation of the Buddha, which is the nature truth body, yeah, which is the also the emptiness of the Buddha's mind. And the Bodhisattva's exalted wisdom, realizing emptiness at that point when they cross over to Buddhahood, their wisdom realizing emptiness becomes the omniscient mind or the Dharmakaya. Okay, so there you see what's happened is, you know, because you have these analogies kind of all the way going up, remember, method aspect of the path, collection of merit, yeah, attaining the Dharmakaya. So here, what is it that attains the Dharmakaya is your true realization, you know, your realization of emptiness becomes the omniscient mind at that point. And the emptiness, the true cessation of the emptiness of the Bodhisattva's mind, the abandonment of the, you know, the true cessation of that Bodhisattva's mind, the level, the abandonment becomes the Buddha's nature truth body. Okay, so there you have the two types of the Dharmakaya. Okay, is that clear? Yeah. And then all the exalted wisdoms in the continuum of a Buddha are omniscient mind. Okay. So in general, the emanation bodies arise from the enjoyment body, which is a dominant condition. So that would be in terms of individual emanation bodies, because it's said that you attain all four Buddha bodies simultaneously. So, of course, different emanation bodies are going to come later when sentient beings get to the time where they need that kind of emanation. So, you know, You actualize the nature truth body, you actualize the wisdom truth body, you actualize the enjoyment body that always stays in the pure land. Okay, and there's one enjoyment body per Buddha. Okay, but there can be many emanation bodies, because the emanation body is the body, the way that the Buddha appears to ordinary sentient beings. The enjoyment body is how they appear for Arya Bodhisattvas. Okay, so the nature, His Holiness has this beautiful way of saying it. Let me see if I can remember it. That the emanation body comes from the enjoyment body. It's produced from the enjoyment body. And the enjoyment body depends on having the omniscient mind of the Buddha. And having the omniscient mind of the Buddha depends on the nature body of the Buddha, the emptiness of a Buddha's mind, the true cessation of a Buddha's mind. So it all kind of goes back to emptiness. Except the way His Holiness explains it makes you go, wow. Yeah, but it is. I mean, even you think about it. Okay. Okay. So then there's different kind of emanation bodies. They talk of three different kinds. One is called the supreme emanation body. That's when the Buddha appears as a wheel-turning Buddha. Okay. In other words, a Buddha that teaches the Dharma in a place where the Buddha has not been taught, where Buddhism, the Dharma has not been taught before. Okay, so it, you know, like Shakyamuni Buddha was the supreme emanation body. Yeah, so they're said to manifest 12 deeds, which I think we get into later. If not, I can bring it in later. And there's different lists of the 12 deeds. You know, they don't all match. Most of them match, but some of them don't. So there's the supreme emanation body. There's the where the Buddha emanates as an artisan. And here they always give the story of somebody who... What's the story? It was somebody who could fine-tune a violin and do it so perfectly that he overcame the arrogance of some man who thought he was like the best violinist. You remember that? Anybody? Yeah? Yeah, so something like that. So he appears as an artisan in some way to overcome the arrogance of some person who's very arrogant. Yeah. So whether, you know, that means you have to be an artisan, maybe you could be a football player that's, you know, overcomes the arrogance of other football players. Yeah. Or you could be a, you know, a ballerina that overcomes the arrogance of other ballerinas, something like that. Or what? Okay. And then the third kind is an ordinary emanation body. And so that's when the Buddha appears just as ordinary living beings. Okay? So, for example, we could say His Holiness is one of these ordinary emanation bodies. He would deny it. That's okay. But we can see him like that anyway. Yeah. So they just appear as ordinary people. In addition, Buddhas can appear as anything. I mean, they can appear as a bridge, as a blanket, as who knows what. You know, sentient beings have the karma to receive benefit from a particular thing, then the Buddhas automatically can manifest without effort as that particular object that that sentient beings has the karma to receive at that time. Okay, they can also manifest as water, earth, fire, you know, as the four elements. And, you know, they do whatever they need to do to benefit sentient beings. So like I said, these emanation bodies, they can appear and then they disappear. So they appear when sentient beings have the karma. When that karma's finished, then they disappear. Okay. Yeah, and then the 10th ground bodhisattvas, they become supreme great lords, meaning that they become Buddhas, okay? So bodhisattvas on all 10 grounds are called great lords, but only the Buddhas are called supreme great lords. But at that time, you probably don't care what they call you. Yeah, they are masters of inconceivable objects of wisdom, meaning that they have attained the omniscience of all beings, of all Buddhas. Okay. So a question comes sometimes, you know, how does that work? Is there one Buddha? Are they all, you know, because there's one passage from, was it Sutra Alamkara? One of them, it talks about all the Buddha's mind streams like flowing together into a great ocean, or are they different mind streams? How does this work? So each Buddha has their own each sentient being has their own individual mind stream. Each Buddha also is an individual Buddha. However, their realizations are exactly the same. So there's no difference in terms of what they've realized, in terms of the content of their mind. It's exactly the same. So it's like in that way they become like one, but they also have their own individual continuities. So maybe it's like you look at a body of water, you could see it as one whole thing, or you could look at it as a collection of drops. But it kind of boils down to the same thing. Okay? Yeah, because I remember Lama Zopa, when he was talking about it, he was saying, you know, how can you say that only one Buddha benefits somebody? I mean, all the Buddhas are trying to benefit all sentient beings. So it couldn't just be that, you know, Tara benefits you and, you know, and medicine Buddha's on vacation. It, you know, they all are there to benefit sentient beings. They're all working 25/8. So, you know, they're all benefiting you. So, you know, but if you say they're all one, then again, that doesn't work either. Okay. And so sometimes where we get confused is, you know, I think you really have to think about emptiness here and how if you've realized emptiness, there really is no sense at all of a personal self that is different from others, you know, and you realize that what you call self is just, you know, it's just something that is designated by conception. That's it. There's nothing else there but that. And, you know, so if you become Buddha in the form of Yamantaka, that does not mean that you can never appear as Tara or Chenrezig or Haruka or, you know, Hayagriva. Okay? So all these Buddhas can appear as each other. Yeah? You may attain awakening in the aspect of one of a particular Buddha, but after you've attained awakening, you can appear as any Buddha who happens to be, or anything whatsoever, even an inanimate object, who happens to be the most effective thing to benefit a particular sentient being at a particular time. Yeah? And all this happens automatically. Yeah, the Buddhas don't have to think about it. Yeah, they don't have to look and say, okay, oh, which sentient being is down there? Okay, yeah. Mm. Huh. Yeah, Susie Q over there, how am I going to benefit her? Yeah. Or Donnie. How am I going to benefit Donnie? Let's see, shall I appear as Tara to Donnie? No, we don't trust.
As long as she dresses as a woman.
And doesn't get very close to him. I think Yamantaka. Yeah? Yeah. Yamantaka, Hayagriva, Madhukalaya, that's how he's going to manifest. Yeah? And so according to, you know, what each particular sentient being needs at a particular time. Huh? We finished that chapter now. Yes, you have a question.
You might have answered it already, but the different wisdoms on the 6th and 10th ground, I'm not so clear about it, actually.
The what?
The different wisdoms, the power of wisdom on the 6th, and then the perfection of wisdom.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. So the one wisdom attained at the 6th ground, one, and then, so that's what's called prajna, and then yeshe, you, on the 10th ground. Yeah. So what do you think is the difference between the wisdom on the 6th ground, the wisdom on the 10th ground? Deeper on the 10th. What else? Yeah, it's on the pure ground, isn't it? So what's supporting it that's different than on the 6th ground? Yeah, they don't have the afflictions underneath it. Yeah, they have more merit. And hardly any defilements left to remove that impede it. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, we tend to think, oh, where it says wisdom, it just means wisdom realizing emptiness. Well, no. It's, remember, because each ground, it is an ultimate ground. An ultimate ground is the wisdom realizing emptiness. Just because they're all the wisdom realizing emptiness, does it mean they're all the same? No. Why not? because other factors on those grounds are different. For example, the amount of merit you have, the degree of afflictions that you've eliminated. Yeah, so what is supporting that realization of emptiness influences that realization of emptiness. You know, we tend to think inherently existent realization of emptiness. There it is. Yeah, independent of all other factors. It has no relationship to anything else that's going on in that mind. Yeah, look at your own mind. Do different things in your own mind influence each other? Yeah. So of course, different, you know, things that are going on with this is going to influence that realization of emptiness. It's still going to realize the same object of emptiness, but that wisdom realizing emptiness on the 10th ground is able to eliminate a degree of defilements that the wisdom realizing emptiness on the 6th ground is not able to eliminate.
So I hear teachings about these, like when you follow the 10 grounds, with the sutra system, is not possible to become a Buddha.
Yeah, they
say. How do you?
Well, the sutra system says you can attain awakening just as I explained it here. The tantric system says that at least by the 10th ground you need to practice the tantric system. Why? Because to become Buddha, you have to make manifest the extremely subtle mind. And it's the tantric teachings, the tantric method that teaches you how to do that. No, they don't have to go back to the beginning. They just have to engage in Vajrayana from there.
I'm not so clear about the form and formless realms, and that from the bodhisattvas on the 8th count, they are moving in that realm, right? And how that looks like and how they're moving into the form and formless realm.
Okay, formless realms, they don't have a body made of form, okay? So the sutra system says they have four aggregates. Tantric system says they have five aggregates. Well, the sutra system doesn't actually say they have four aggregates. They say they have the seed of form, but they don't really have a body at that point. In the form realm, they still have a body, but it's a much subtler body, not as gross as ours. Yeah, and most, you know, a lot, because they've attained certain degrees of dhyana, of meditative stabilization, they spend a lot of time in their meditation where it's very, very blissful. And then sometimes they come out of their meditation and I guess they hang out together because, you know, Brahma thought he created the world, so he must not have been in meditation at that time. And I don't know, you've been born there in previous lives, can't you remember? Well, neither can I. So your assignment is to tell us. Yeah, no, this is good. We'll get some answers, okay? About the form realm. And about, you know, what they do in the form realm.